Hello, I'm Rob Califf, and I want to welcome you to another one of our interviews with famous people in cardiology. And as all of you know who have followed the series, what I'm really interested in is what makes someone become a leader in cardiology, and what can we learn from leaders about what has motivated them that might be passed on to other people. And so often people get attached to the stories, and it helps them as they're trying to figure out what to do with their own careers and their own lives. So I'm really thrilled today at the European Society of Cardiology to have a friend and colleague, Jean-Pierre Vasson from France, who I got to know as president of the European Society of Cardiology and also as a great golfing colleague and adversary. We have had some really fun matches and discussions about golf, but also about cardiology. So Jean-Pierre, welcome.
Thank you, Rob. Well, no need for me to introduce myself, but I'm Jean-Pierre Vasson. I'm at the University Hospital of Besançon in the east part of France. And it's true that I've spent my career, I don't like the word career. I would say I would prefer saying professional life at working in cardiology. Why cardiologist was just like this. At the time of residency, I was sure that I wanted to become a cardiologist. And funnily enough, because I thought at this time that cardiology was just easy business, easy discipline. At this time, you were virtually not born. I started in cardiology in 1971. You were still in the kindergarten.
Actually, I was in the university at that time.
Oh, you were at the university. Congratulations. You started very young. but in 1971, remember, this was the turning point, I would say, of cardiology. In 1971, what did we have? Just nothing. Stethoscopes. There was no echocardiography, but just starting. We had EKG, flow mechanography. And that basically all. Coronary angiography, CABG surgery had started a few years before, 4 years before. And do you remember the Weinberg operation was still in use in 1971?
Actually, you know, as a medical student, I had gotten involved in clinical research, and I was an expert at the time in computerized databases. I actually went and spent time with Dr. Weinberg trying to resuscitate his records.
Oh, really?
But that's another story. But let's get back to more early days. And, you know, the audience for these interviews is global, but there are a lot of Americans. And I think you understand that France is always a little bit mysterious to Americans. Tell us about your family when you were a child. Your parents, what did they do for a living? And where did you grow up?
That's a pretty good question. I was number six of a family of seven children.
Wow.
Yeah, and we are all completely different. And then I'm the only one who embraced an academic career in my family. My brothers and sisters made completely different things and matters. I'm the only one to embrace an academic career. How did this happen? Just like this. I was quite good at school, secondary school, and then I moved to the medical school, and then I wanted to become a cardiologist. The problem is that I've spent all my lifetime in the same place in France, and particularly in the same university. And the reason is very clear. In France, it's very difficult to move from one university to another university, at least in medical field, after residency. If you want to move, then you have to do that at the time of residency. But at this time, residency was based on a contest. You could go to any university you wanted to go, pass this contest, and you could choose depending on your ranking. And just like this, I was number one in my home university. And that's the reason why I stayed in the same place. But it was possibly not too bad a choice, because it didn't prevent me from being more or less successful. I contest the term of leader. I don't see myself as a leader. I'm involved in cardiology, I'm enthusiastic about cardiology, but leader, I don't know what it means exactly. If you compare to some leaders that you have interviewed, say, I cannot be called a leader compared to Jim Bono, to Peter Sight, to Salim Yusuf, to big shots like this. I spent my time doing cardiology, trying to do my best. And the point is that in my university, when I started, there was no cardiology in the hospital. No cardiology work, nothing. So I started from scratch.
What?
And there was no possibility to link to a basic science research lab. And then that's the reason why I started from the beginning to develop clinical cardiology, of course, the department, of course, but also clinical research.
Well, but let's go back again. What did your parents do for a living?
My parents.
Did you grow up in a city or
my
was it countryside
was,
or?
They were, well, I lived my childhood in the countryside because my father was a cheesemaker.
Wow.
What the American call the Swiss cheese.
Swiss cheese.
The Swiss cheese is the same, basically the same in France. It's called differently, but the same kind of food. So it was quite good at this.
So not the, I mean, when I think of French cheese, I think of the really tart.
Well, this is not too strong.
Not too strong.
Not too strong.
Wow, so your father, and was your mother a homemaker? Did she
was a homemaker.
She took care of seven children.
Oh, taking care of seven children was in a really difficult job like cheesemaker in the countryside, and particularly during wartime was particularly difficult. And well, this is another matter, but we may mention that they were living in the countryside in occupied France, in the occupied part of France. And you know that till 1942, France was divided in two parts. And my family used to live in the occupied part by the Germans. And what I know, I was too young because I was born in 1943, but I've learned that afterwards, that my family, and particularly my mother, took care of people who wanted to cross the line of demarcation line, and particularly the pilots, airmen who were gunned down by the German flak and wanted to escape and go to Switzerland or go to Spain and then go back to England. But I've learned that afterwards, and simply in discovering a certificate that had been issued by Charles de Gaulle in person.
Wow.
I was impressed. I said, hey, mother, mom, what is this? Oh, come on. And why the mother and not the father? Because a couple was relatively unnoticed by policemen or in the army. So she took care. Then I heard that there were relays, and she took care of a guy for 10-15 kilometers.
Pass him off to them.
Pass him on to someone else.
That's fantastic.
So I'm very proud of my mother.
Well, it's such an important part of our generational history, yeah. The good and the bad. You know, my dad was in the Battle of the Bulge.
I know. You told me we were together in a meeting in Brussels. What was it, Brussels?
Yeah.
And you wanted to go back to the Battle of Bastogne.
Yeah.
Yeah. Where the American army was surrounded by the Germans, and the people in Bastogne handed out their drapes,
yeah.
Because it was during winter time, it was snow.
Terrible snowstorm.
And the Americans had no possibility to hide themselves, so they gave some drapes, you know, the sheet of their beds, for the Americans to cover themselves in white. Incredible.
So when you were growing up then, and with a cheesemaker father and all your siblings, what did you think about Americans?
I love this question. I love answering this question. Why? Because anti-Americanism is very common in France. At least the Americans believe that it's very common. But it's very common among the self-appointed intellectuals. Very common among the journalists, they're all leftists. It's very common in this sort of people. But average French, they are not anti-American at all. And people my generation, we know what we owe the Americans and the English during wartime. And they were considered, and still considered, of our liberators. And it's quite clear. So the rest is just politics and dirty politics. And the pity, if we come back to a recent history, is the pity that some recent American president destroyed in just two terms all the credit that had been, let's say, collected by the Americans in France and Europe, generally speaking, over the last 50 years. But the tide will come back. In other words, I don't think that the French are anti-American.
In the end, we're all the same, and I agree with you. It will come back, and we experience that on the golf course.
Yeah, but you know, the Americans are not perfect. The French are not perfect either. But it's just ridiculous to, let's say, discuss about antagonisms between Americans and French. And you know, I happened to meet a person in Philadelphia at a very short connecting time. I had a flight to go to ACC or AHA, and I handed over my passport to the guy at the booth and said, "Oh, sir, you are French." And I said, "Yes. I'm very glad to greet you." And why? Because my mother always told me the French helped us gaining our independence. 2 centuries later.
Absolutely, yes.
It's incredible. I was very touched, you know. So anti-Americanism don't really exist in France. And it's probably the same, the anti-French feeling in the U.S. I don't think that's really deeply rooted. I don't think.
Now, in France, you go to medical school right out of high school, right?
Yes.
Did you ever think about being anything other than a doctor?
No.
When did you decide you wanted to be a doctor? How old were you?
I decided the very day I passed my exam at the end of secondary school. It is called baccalaureat. It was the same as Abitur in Germany. So, and the math teacher was just next to me when we got the results. They said, "What do you want to do next?" I said, "Medicine." "You want to become a doctor?" "Yes." "Why?" "I don't even know." It was just like this. Just
really?
Like this, yes.
Wow. And so you enrolled in medical school in the same
area. University. And then, well, the first 5 years are... The first year was difficult. But after the first year, it's an easy job. And then you have the residency. And then you have to go through a contest. And as I explained to you, you could choose a specialty after being successful at gaining residency. And then it's the only opportunity you have to go to another university.
So is there a bit of a... You know, in America, if you're not in Boston or you're not maybe in San Francisco, you're sort of out in the country. Is there a similar issue in France? If you're not in Paris, is that...
Come on, you know that better than I do. If you are not from Paris, you are just ordinary citizen. Small-time citizen. If you are not from Paris, or big universities to a lesser extent, because, you know, the people from Lille, people from Rennes, people from Toulouse are less contemptuous to the rest of France. The Parisians are very contemptuous to what they call the provincials. People living in a province means not living in Paris, not studying in Paris, not working in Paris. And then for the Parisian cardiologists, it was a big surprise to see someone from a rather small university, say, growing up and doing good.
So I think you've been very clear that you decided to become a doctor at the spur of the moment, but you loved it. Cardiology seemed like just a natural thing to do because it seemed easy for you to do. And I think, I actually believe in my interviews and also having mentored a lot of young people, there is something intuitive about cardiology that certain people just gravitate to. But then you said you finished, and now you're in a hospital with no history of having cardiology services. Who did you rely on for advice and help in those early years?
Oh, that's a pretty delicate question, because I started from scratch. And my boss was some kind of... 19th century doctor using only stethoscope and physical examination, nothing else, giving digoxin and lasics, and that's it, and vitamin K antagonists, of course. And that was basically all. So, and this is one of the most difficult part of my professional life, because I had to start from scratch and gain expertise, expertise and experience by myself, and rushing to a place another here and there to have, to let's say, go for a new technique and port it back in my department. And this is one of the great regrets of my professional life. I would have loved to spend at least a year abroad, particularly in the United States, and come back fully trained. But I had to develop the department, because my boss was not very active and he relied on me. Develop the department, gain expertise, grab experience from, and grab knowledge from some other places. And this was very exciting, but really, really a real burden on your shoulders. So to make a long story short, it's not, it's true to say that I worked like hell for decades. But at the end of the day, you know, it's paying off, because little by little, then you are better known, you have a good department of cardiology running well, then you started we started thrombolytic treatment in pulmonary embolism first, and acute myocardial infarction in 71-72.
That was very...
At this time, we injected 100,000 units of streptokinase for 24 hours. And guess what? We got some results. Yeah. Ventricular arrhythmias that we know now relate to reperfusion, and also a big bump of enzyme after 24 hours. We could not interpret this, and we know now, so it's just a washout of enzymes occurring in the time of reperfusion. But we had to wait another almost 10 years to get the demonstration from Wood.
Right.
Dewood,
Marcus
and
DeWood.
Peter Weintraub, that reopening the artery did the job. We didn't even know what streptokinase was doing. And I would encourage you to go back to a paper published in 1979 in the New England Journal of Medicine by the European Cardiology Group, which randomized 500 patients, streptokinase or no streptokinase, and there was a mortality benefit at 6 months. What is important? Is the interpretation of the data. And they thought that the job was done by a reduction in fibrinogen level, less viscosity, decreasing afterload, and unloading the heart and improving LV function, which eventually resulted in a mortality benefit. But you know, it was just for almost 40 years ago. In 40 years from now, I'm sure that cardiologists will laugh after what we have done in 2012.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
So in the midst of all this, of exciting developing a department and all the new technology, you also were developing a family. And I know you've just been through a rough time with
quite,
your wife.
Quite a difficult time, yes.
Condolences. I know she had cancer and recently passed away. But you, I remember from our visit with you on the golfing tour that you hosted, you did have a very nice family life.
Yeah, we had a, well, quite nice family life, to be precise. Well, the one who died, it was my second wife, but with my first wife, we couldn't have children, and we got two adopted children, and they are from Indian origin, so my children are Indian, and Indian from India, not from North America. And as a result, my granddaughter is Indian, and my great granddaughter is Indian as well. I'm a great grandfather. Can you believe it?
Wow, that's amazing.
I'm not particularly excited about this because it was a rather early pregnancy in a teenager, and it's not the best, a good start in life, I would say.
But these things sometimes turn out quite well.
Yeah.
That And
young.
Your two children, what did they what did they end up doing?
Oh, my daughter was started in a hotel business, and then she moved flight attendant. And now she's more or less she's difficult for the moment, but she's going to overcome the situation. And my son is incredible. Possibly between age 20 to age 44, he's 44 now, he went for, say, 20 different jobs.
Wow.
And now he's selling wind, what I call selling wind. In other words, he's in a communication business.
Ah.
And he's very successful, But also he has got some acquaintances in the political field, and he's supporting one of the senators. But he's living in Mauritius, not Mauritius, but Reunion Island, next to Mauritius in the South
wow.
Hemisphere. So in November, I will leave the North Hemisphere, go to this place, and live eternal summer. Summertime in North Hemisphere, summertime
in
South Hemisphere. Yeah.
That's great. And so you evolved in your practice, and somehow you became very involved in European cardiology organization.
Yeah.
How did that happen?
People, yeah, but you're asking the same question as many people ask. In other words, how did you manage to become the president? And it just happened like this. You know, remember Michel Bertrand, I will be very honest with you. Michel Bertrand approached me and said, Jean-Pierre, I will step down from the board of society in 1996, and then we need to have a French on board. I say, no way, I do not want to go. Yes, you have to go. You have to go. Because I believe you are the only one who can make it, but you have to know something. You have no chance to become the president. Because I've been for 2 terms, and then they are fed up with the French, no French for another 20 years. And guess what happened? Just 5 years later, I became the president. But it just came like this. I didn't fight for that. I'm not this kind of person. My ambition in life was to have a successful department with patients taken care of very nicely and efficaciously, with a smiling staff, and no fight without the department between doctors. And for this, I was quite successful. And now my collaborators are fighting like hell to maintain this kind of organization and spirit. You know how to build a team. Team building just gives a spirit of it. And I'm very glad for that and very proud. All the rest occurred just like this, because you are involved in clinical research, and then you become an investigator in trials, and then you are asked to be national lead investigator, and then a steering committee, and then blah blah blah, and then you end up in a really, let's say, exciting situation. The most rewarding for me was to be able to be in touch with great leaders, real leaders, not like me, real leaders in cardiology, like you, like Jean, like Salim, like Peter Schleit, and many others. It was a great achievement for me to be in this, in touch with these people, because this is where excitement is.
Well, I would submit that your rendition of this displays the personality characteristics of someone who gets people to work together in a nice way, and that's appreciated by others.
Absolutely critical.
Well, just a few more questions. So now you're at a juncture, I know, with changes in your life. You told me you've been walking for a month in a pilgrimage across France into Spain by yourself.
Yeah.
What do you say, let's start with the future for cardiology, particularly for European cardiology. What do you see over the next 5 to 10 years?
This is the trickiest question you have asked so far. The future of cardiology. we have to separate, actually we should not do that, but we have to separate prevention from treatment. And you know better than I do that prevention is doing most of the job, be it primary prevention or secondary prevention, often neglected, unfortunately. And you know that in the future, primary prevention will be key, because what you have experienced during the last 30 years in the U.S. is spreading like wildfire all over the planet, obesity and diabetes. And we are experiencing the same in Western world, and it's spreading in India, in China, in Brazil, everywhere. So we have to fight against this, obesity and cigarette smoking. I don't know for the U.S., but in Europe now, the youngsters smoke like hell, and particularly the females, the girls. So primary prevention will be absolutely key, but it's not fashionable. It's difficult to achieve and not fashionable for the cardiologists. Secondary prevention is much easier to achieve, at least in terms of medical treatment and medical therapy. But for curative medicine, the future of cardiology will probably be in genomics and genetics, most probably in 20 years from now. It's not specific to cardiology. I would say the same will happen in other disciplines, just like cancer, oncology. We'll have shown in 20 years from now that many diseases, including cancer, are probably genetically determined. We have already a lot of candidate genes. It's probably not one determinant, multifactorial. I truly believe that environment plays a role, but not a major role, in the occurrence of cancer and possibly in the occurrence of cardiovascular disease. So, but in the next 20 years, maybe interventional cardiology will have the same fate as a cardiovascular surgery. In other words,
less invasive,
less full metal jackets, and less aggressive treatment of not so stenotic coronary arteries. I mean, coronary lesion or stenotic areas. Was just gut reaction, but I didn't think over this for the next 20 years. No doubt that the progress that we're experiencing in drug treatment will keep going. We have seen fantastic achievements during the last 30 years with its ACE inhibitors. When I started, the mean survival of patients with heart failure developed after acute myocardial infarction was just like acute leukemia, 18 months, no more. With just a pill a day, then you prolong by 7 or 8 years. So we have seen ACE inhibitors, many other drugs, new oral anticoagulants. We may get rid at a point in time of vitamin K antagonists, and we are not going to cry about vitamin K antagonists. And it was just gut reactions, but I would have needed to think over a little bit.
Well, the last question, this may be the toughest one, but maybe you figured this out on your walk. What about your next 5 to 10 years?
My next what?
5 to 10 years. What are you going to do?
I'm very hesitant, because for reasons that you mentioned, I'm at the moment rather demotivated, and I'm tempted at let's say laisser tomber les outils in French, means that drop the tools and live your own life. And some of my friends told me, don't do that, because you are going to feel idle. And if you drop the tools and stop working in this kind of business in academic field, you will no longer see your friends. And it's a major argument. But I feel demotivated a little bit, so I may change my mind.
I'll bet you will.
And, well, I don't know yet. And I'm a keen traveler. I love traveling. My plan is to track down the ancestors of my two kids, and I want to spend several weeks, or not to say months, in India, living or traveling at least like an Indian, by train, not by plane. And going, in, particularly in Tamil Nadu, southeast part of India, searching books, trying to find out where they come from and who the ancestors were. It's a very difficult task because, you know, the name were changed, the names were changed, the spelling of the same family name, depending on whether it's spelled in English or French, is different. So that might be a task beyond my means, but I would like to test this. I need to do two things before dying. Going to Machu Picchu in Peru, you know what it is.
Oh, yeah.
Walking all the way up to Machu Picchu and all the... And spending, if possible, a few weeks in Botswana. Botswana is a country north of South Africa, the size of France, 1.5 million inhabitants, with a big river in the middle called Okavango that disappears in the desert, never reaches the coastline because it fades away in a Kalahari desert. And this part is just like a delta, and there are a huge number of animals. And this part of the world is just like God made it. And they accept tourists, but not too many. And I would like to go there, camping in the wild, taking a chance being killed by a lion. It's much easier death than spending 2 months of your life in a palliative care center with massive amounts of morphine, if you see what I mean. So, traveling, but seeing my friends is also very, very rewarding. So I may reconsider my decision to drop my tools.
Don't drop your tools. I hope you don't, because we need you in the world.
No, at least to chat a little bit and share good times and good moments.
Well, thanks for spending this time with us. It was a great discussion.
Thank you.
Very much appreciate it.